All right, I guess we'll get started here. Now that you're all experts on local dynamical systems, and we'll do a couple dynamical systems now, and averaging and fun stuff like that. If I write over here, is this blocking it or not?
Yeah.
Okay. I didn't know how far over I could go. All right, page one, reduction methods. Okay. So, let me briefly talk about coupling relaxation oscillators and give you kind of a nice, cute idea why one expects synchrony in certain kinds of relaxation oscillators. All right. And I'm going to do a really simplified model here with really simplified synapses. I just want to present this so you can kind of get a geometric flavor. And then I'm going to go from there into averaging and things like that. But as long as we're talking about coupled oscillators, I'll start with something really simple like relaxation oscillators. All right, so here's your typical relaxation oscillator. X dot equals f of x, y dot equals g of x, y. With an epsilon in front of it, all right? Mathematicians always have epsilons, okay? So do physicists, I guess. The difference is that we do them rigorously and, no, I'm kidding. Okay, so we have these little epsilons in here, and so this y variable is much, much slower. And let me draw a picture of the phase plane of this, okay? So the phase plane for this oscillator looks like this. All right. But the details of the noclines aren't so important. But it looks like this, okay? This would be a typical thing. And what happens, all right? Because epsilon's small, okay, you don't change much in the y direction as you go across in the x direction. So you go over here, and then you follow this slow process, then you jump back here. This happens rather quickly, and then you follow down here. Like this. Okay? So that's a typical relaxation oscillator. Everybody who's ever looked at the Van der Pol oscillator or anything like that will recognize that. Now there's crucial things that are there's several things that are important I want to point out. Okay? In a typical neural model, you can sometimes arrange neural models to look like relaxation oscillations. The path down here is quite a bit slower than the path up here. Okay? In many neural models. And that just says, if you look at the spike of a neural model, the recovery period is much shorter than the time at which it spends spiking, which is right here. So here we really got to make this a little bit more like that. Okay? So it doesn't spend as much time on this branch as it does on here. Okay? Everybody understand? And so, if it spent the same amount of time, the oscillation would look like this, like a square wave or something like that. But it's much longer recovery than it is in the spiking phase. So now, let's suppose we'll put a little indices on here. And we'll add a coupling term. And we'll have a similar equation to this guy. Okay? And the key point here is, what does this coupling do? We're going to pretend that this coupling is zero if the neuron is in the silent phase. This is the silent phase, the non-spiking phase. And we'll assume it's roughly constant when it's in the spiking phase. Right? See what I mean? So what does that do? Well, if this is a positive constant, what this does is lift this nocline up. Alright? So when x2 is spiking, this nocline gets lifted up like that. Alright? Everybody see? So that's the idea of the model. Now you can justify this if you could put time-dependent synapses and things and like that in there. But if you assume that this is like a burster, so there's lots of spikes, so the synapse stays up for a while and there's no synaptic depression. I apologize, Mish. There's no synaptic depression or facilitation. So the synapse stays hanging up there for a while. Then it's almost as though it's on when the neurons fire in the spiking phase of the burst, and it's off otherwise. So this might be viewed more as a model for coupled bursters. And now I want to explain geometrically why you expect them to synchronize. Okay, and here's why. It's really quite, it's an idea that was invented by Nancy Capel and Dave Turman. It's called fast threshold modulation. And it's very straightforward. Let's suppose that both neurons are in the silent phase. Okay? So both neurons are right here in their silent phase. Okay? This neuron is behind this guy. Okay? So now what happens? This guy goes across, he crosses. He has to jump over here. So he goes over here. Okay? That immediately lifts the null cline up. And this guy, therefore, if he's close enough, if he's below this knee where it gets lifted up, has to shoot over here. All right? So do you see what I mean? You see why? This null cline gets lifted up, and this branch, you're no longer sitting on this branch. You want to be on this branch, but you're below this knee, so you have to shoot over here. So now you're firing ahead of him. Notice that the geometric distance between these two is exactly the same. However, because the dynamic is much faster on here, the temporal, think of the time it would take you to go from here to here. The time it would take you from go to here is a long time compared to the time it takes you to go from here to here. So you achieve what's called temporal compression. So by the time you get up to here, these guys are really close to each other. All right? Now this guy jumps across. That lowers this null cline. This guy has to jump across, and he's ahead again. But now he's ahead by far less of an amount. And so you get this compression. So you can see mathematically how you could develop a simple map, which tells you how far apart you are. And that map is a contraction, and that's why synchrony will be stable for this type of thing. Now there's all kinds of cool subtleties. For example, if things slow down here, or things are fast here, you can get all kinds of interesting behavior depending on what your dynamics along these two branches are. All right, so, yes?
Once again, the coupling does is to compress the y direction.
It compresses, all the coupling does geometrically is lift these null clines up and down. But what it does effectively, mathematically, is to compress the effective temporal distance. See, what you've done is taken something that's a very long temporal distance away and converted it to something that's a very short temporal distance. Because the spiking is so much faster on here, it takes no time to get from here, very little time to get from here to here. So these guys come together, and when they come back again, they're now much closer in time. Huh?
How do we know that the vertical branch has to compress?
What about vertical?
Going that vertical, the opposite of vertical.
Because of the...
Sorry, yeah. The movement along the upward part there.
Here.
How do we know that it has to compress the distance?
Why do they have to... Wait.
How do we know that it has to compress as opposed to expand?
Yeah, you have to make some other hypotheses that things are... basically, here's one way to look at it. Look at the null cline here. It curves around here. So things slow down a little bit here. So the guys in back are going up faster. Okay, so you have to make some specific hypotheses on this. But this is... I'm basically just hand-waving, giving you an intuition for why these kinds of relaxation oscillations tend to synchronize with excitatory coupling. And they synchronize rather quickly. And they're also almost independent of intrinsic frequency because of this compression. So even though they have widely different frequencies, they'll spike at pretty similar times. Okay? So that's just why relaxation oscillations happen, are really fast. They synchronize fast. Now, if you put synapses that have slow time scales, it becomes more complicated, because if you have two slow variables, it becomes the analysis is much more delicate. Again, I would point out, there's some nice papers, a nice review paper. I have a copy of it here. I think it's coming out in the Handbook of Dynamical Systems. It's a nice review paper by Dave Terman and John Rubin. And I'm sure you can get a preprint if you ask Terman. He's going to be here for the whole time. All right, and that's just sort of a back of the envelope reason why relaxation oscillations synchronize with excitatory coupling. Now, the other side of the coin is if you have inhibitory coupling, then you expect them to oscillate out of phase with each other. And there's a classic model for central pattern generators called a half-center oscillator. Two guys, if you talk to anybody that does central pattern generation, they'll talk about mutually inhibitory coupling across the two halves, and that gives rise to this out-of-phase motion. And of course, that's completely valid in this relaxation thing. You get exactly that. They want to go out of phase. The analysis is much more complicated than synchrony. But you can still do it, and you can show that there's an out-of-phase solution for these with inhibitory coupling. Okay? But now I want to get away from the relaxation stuff and now talk about more traditional spiking models, and I'm going to start with the theory of averaging with what's called weak coupling. Now that's another assumption. I told you every single thing I'm going to talk about in terms of reducing models assumes something is small, all right? Because you can't get something for nothing. You always have to make some simplifying assumption. If you could reduce every model in the world down to one or two variables, no matter what, well, that would be really cool. But on the one hand, on the other hand, you'd probably lose a lot of complexity and inability to do much. Behaviorally. However, so all these things are carried with caveats that I'm doing this as a mathematician to make life easier and also to try and shed some insight into what's going on with more complicated networks of neurons and other things. All right, so here's the idea. The idea is, I'm going to start with, I want to make sure I keep the right notation, because don't want to change notation in the middle of x dot equals f sub x. Okay. So I'm going to start with a very general dynamical system. I'm going to take two identical dynamical systems, and I'm going to weakly couple them to each other. Okay? So epsilon is a small parameter. Epsilon, small positive parameter. I'm going to allow the coupling to be different. I don't care about that. The key thing is that they are both identical to order epsilon, at least. All right? Any heterogeneities I can include in this term. All right, so now what are my assumptions? I'm going to assume that this equation has an asymptotically stable periodic orbit, okay? So this has a limit cycle. Right. Incidentally, these are all in some n-dimensional space. N has got to be bigger than 2, because otherwise I wouldn't be able to get limit cycles. Right. So there's the existence, here's the idea. Now, as I mentioned earlier today, both of these guys are limit cycles. And if you don't couple them, you expect this two-dimensional torus to be sitting around, right? Because they each have 2 degrees of freedom, arbitrariness and phase. This guy could be spiking like this. This guy's spiking at a different phase difference. But they're going at the same period, okay? So now what I want to ask is, what is the behavior of the coupled system? Can I say anything about that? And it turns out the answer is absolutely, if you make the right assumptions. And the assumption I'm going to start out with, the simplest general idea, is to assume weak coupling. So how do I solve this problem? How do I do this? Well, you guys are physicists, so you're all used to perturbation expansions, right? Everybody's done a perturbation expansion. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to assume that I'm going to write down x of t equals c of theta sub x plus epsilon x1 plus epsilon squared x2 and so on and so forth, okay? And y of t equals c of theta sub y plus epsilon y1 plus epsilon squared y2, and so on and so forth. So I'm just doing a regular old perturbation expansion. Okay, you guys probably all seen these things ad infinitum. Oh. And what one finds is you can write down a differential equation for theta sub x and theta sub y. And that differential equation has the following form. Theta sub x dot equals 1 plus epsilon h sub x of theta sub x or theta sub y minus theta sub x plus O of epsilon squared. So you end up with two equations that are scalars. Now, the key thing in all the art and all the science in this is to figure out what the heck these functions look like and whether you can relate them to anything biological or biophysical, or and then assuming that, then what's the behavior of this small system? Okay? And then, of course, you can see how to arbitrarily to couple a whole million of these guys together. You can do the same thing. You just couple them all up in the same way, and you get a more complicated set of equations. But there's two points that are really important here. One is these are all periodic functions of their arguments. And two, and this is what makes it a whole lot easier, is everything appears only as the phase difference. So what the hell is this h of x? What does h look like? Well, to do that, I have to introduce a little more notation. I apologize if this becomes overly technical. All right. Let's linearize this differential equation about the limit cycle. Now remember, that gave us an equation of the form z dot equals a of t z. Remember? Where a of t is d sub c f of c about, or f of d sub x, f of x evaluated at x equals c of t. So it's the derivative, it's the Jacobian matrix, the derivative of f, just like you would around a fixed point. When you linearize around a fixed point, you linearize around the limit cycle, and you get a periodic function, a of t. You get a periodic function here, t periodic function of, it's a matrix. It's just a two-dimensional, or n by n, two-dimensional matrix, okay? And remember I told you before, if you have an asymptotically stable limit cycle, then the flow K multipliers are all inside the unit circle save one. All right, so there exists one mu. Remember those mu's I told you about? Remember the solution to this is Z of t equals P of t e to the mu t. And P of t is a periodic function. It's different for each mu. And remember, I told you because it's an autonomous equation, there exists exactly one value of mu equal to zero. So that there is a periodic solution to this equation. That periodic solution is easy. I'll leave it as an exercise. The periodic solution to this is z dot of t. You can prove very easily. Just use the chain rule. Everybody knows the chain rule. And if you don't, then I will be forced to do wrapping calculus for you. But if you're down and out and your life's a bust, you know, and so on. It's because you didn't learn the calculus? Well, later on. All right, so C dot satisfies this equation. That's easy. Just differentiate this thing with respect to time and use the chain rule. So far, I haven't told you anything too interesting. Now, let's look at another equation. Let's look at this equation. Z dot equals minus A of t transpose times z. Let's look at that equation. This is called the adjoint linear operator to this. All right? Those of you who know some physics know, you remember in linear algebra that, remember from linear algebra that x dot a y is equal to a transpose x dot y. Remember that? That's a classic linear algebra stuff. You'll learn that in freshman linear algebra. Well, you don't take linear algebra as a freshman. You learn that in linear algebra. Okay. Well, these are just linear operators. This is just a linear operator and working on periodic functions. And so you have the same sort of thing. And it turns out that the adjoint operator looks like this. And there exists a unique solution here to this, a unique periodic solution, zeta of t. That's the unique periodic solution, zeta of t plus capital T equals zeta of t, such that zeta of t, the inner product of zeta of t dot C dot of t equals 1 for all t. Okay? So that is a very crucial function, this zeta of t. And that's the periodic solution, normalized periodic solution to the adjoint. All right? And I will give you some intuition about what the hell that is very shortly. All right? But bear with me. Assume that it is there and don't try and worry too much about what it means, okay? Because I will confer meaning to it very shortly. All right?
Huh? Take the limit cycle solution, you perturb it by a little bit, and Z is the deviation.
Z would be the deviation and the relaxation back. This is not that. This is the... This one. That's... C dot... That's right. And this is the unique periodic, this is a periodic solution to this equation. This is going to be the unique periodic solution to this that satisfies this. Now satisfies this. Now what is that, I'll come back to what zeta is. Let me point out the third most important theorem in all of applied math. What's the first most important theorem in all of applied math? The implicit function theorem. There's no other you disagree? No. You agree? Yeah. Okay. I won't say what the second one is, but the third one, because that one varies. But the third most important is the Fredholm alternative theorem. And that's a really neat theorem. It says that we can solve the linear system AX equals B if and only if B is orthogonal to all solutions to A transpose z equals 0. That's the linear algebra version. Same thing here, okay? So it turns out that using that, you can now write down what h is. And I'll write down what h is presently. And then what we'll do is we'll apply it to biology. H of phi is the average, I told you the averaging theorem shows up in here, 1 over t to t, zeta of t dot g of there it is. That's what the h of phi is. Okay? So that looks awful because it doesn't seem to be, it seems hopeless to relate this to biophysics and to biology. And for many years I was of the opinion that it was hopeless to relate it. But as I got older and mellower and less set in my ways, when you have kids, you become more flexible. Anybody who has kids recognizes that. Either that or you become, like a priest. I shouldn't say, never talk about religion and politics. Anyway, but I'm an equal opportunity insulter, so don't feel too bad. Anyway, H of phi is this. All right, it's the average of this funny looking thing with the coupling, the effective coupling. Okay? So now let's be a little more specific and a little more precise. Let's suppose that we're working on biophysical models. All right? So let's suppose that we have membrane type models. CdVdt equals all your ionic stuff. Okay, and now what about your coupling plus epsilon times S sub y, or S of t, times V minus. All right, so there's a typical kind of synaptic coupling. S is the synapse from the other neuron. This is your voltage and your reversal potential, okay? You guys talked about synapses and biophysics of synapses, right? To some extent. I mean, how to model them. They're modeled just like voltage-gated ion channels, but now these S's obey certain differential equations that don't depend on this voltage, but they depend on the other voltage, the guy to which you're coupled to, okay? Everybody see what I mean? Or not? All right, so the neat thing, and then there's all this other crap. The neat thing about these membrane models, of course, therefore, is that the coupling occurs only in one variable. The only coupling occurs in the voltage, right? You don't see, H doesn't get coupled to, the inactivation of sodium isn't coupled to the other inactivation of sodium or to anything else. Only the voltage is affected. So all we need here is the voltage component of this, right? Because this is the dot product, but all other the coupling looks like this. G looks like something here, and then zero everywhere else, okay? Everybody see, right? That's the beauty of membrane models. The coupling only is through via the voltage. All roads go through the voltage. It's what's called a mammillary system. All right, mammillary systems are systems where there's one mama and then there's all these little babies that are coupled up to it. That's what they call these things, a mammillary system. It's a matrix that looks like this. And then zeros everywhere else. It's such a great term. I mean, you always have to introduce it, you know. Mammillary. It's like, you know, like a hog with all the little babies on there. In any case, only coupling is through the voltage, all right? So all we need is the voltage component of this. Now, what is the voltage component of that adjoint? Now, remember the phase response curve? I told you about the phase response curve. And somebody very nicely set me up for this. They said, what about different amplitudes? So let's suppose we have a phase response curve and we take some infinitesimally small perturbation. Right? So suppose we parameterize the phase response curve by the size of the perturbation. All right? So we have this phase response curve parameterized by the size of the perturbation, such that as lambda goes to zero, the perturbation goes to zero. Okay? Then it turns out that the voltage component of this thing is the limit as lambda goes to zero of this over lambda. Okay? So it's essentially the derivative, I mean, it's the limiting size of the infinitesimal, it's the infinitesimal phase response curve. So it turns out that if you numerically compute this thing, and you compare it to a phase response curve you get by applying a square wave pulse, it really doesn't look a whole lot different. So in fact, this zeta is basically, the voltage component of this zeta is essentially all those curves that I drew earlier. It's like those. It's just the phase response curve. Okay? So therefore, so now let's take a look a little bit more at the coupling. All right? We have h of phi is 1 over t times the integral from 0 to t, s of t plus phi. That's the presynaptic guy, right? Times the voltage component of this times v of t, times v reversal. What do I call it, e reversal or v reversal? E reversal. Okay, so suddenly some things are becoming clarified in this. What is this interaction function? You take a convolution, essentially, of the synaptic time course. Maybe it's an alpha function or something like that, with the effective response of the neuron to a perturbation. So it makes beautiful sense. That's essentially what you're doing. You're averaging over all time that effect. Okay? So if this was just like a delta function, then this becomes almost like the phase response curve. So, now let's keep this one in the back of our mind. Keep that formula there. So this is for membrane type models. This is what the interaction function is. And this is essentially like the infinite. This whole thing is almost like, for all intents and purposes, this looks very much like this. Because this guy's pretty flat except when it spikes. And when it spikes, this is zero. Remember the phase response curve was zero at the ends at the time of the spikes. Remember that? So the spike doesn't make much difference, and everywhere else the reversal potential for, say, excitatory neurons is quite a bit above where the potential is. Most of the time it's down there at minus 80. So this is roughly constant times this. So this really looks a whole lot like the phase response curve. Okay? So let's keep that guy in mind, and now we'll turn to analyzing these little guys. So let's take a pair of them. Theta sub x dot equals 1 plus epsilon hx theta y minus theta x. Theta sub y dot equals 1 plus epsilon hy theta sub y minus theta sub x. All right, so here we have two guys. And let's introduce the phase difference between them. So let phi be theta sub y minus theta sub x. Okay, it's just the timing between them. And what's phi dot satisfy? phi dot equals epsilon h sub x of minus phi minus h sub x of, or h sub y, right? Or h sub y of phi. Lo and behold, we've reduced the whole system of coupled biophysical oscillators to a scalar differential equation whose fixed points tell us what all possible timing differences are stable on that torus. So here's the idea geometrically. We have this two-dimensional torus, okay? Solutions on it are going to be closed curves on the torus, okay? So you have this torus and you cruise around. Here, I'm going to unfold the torus. Everybody know how to unfold a torus? You know how to make a torus? You take the paper, you identify these two ends, then you roll it over and identify those. What happens if you take these two ends and identify it, roll this, push it through and twist it once and join it there? What do you get? Klein bottle. You get the Klein bottle. All right, here's an exercise for you. Prove that every equation of this form prove that all solutions to this on a Klein bottle go to periodic orbits. Okay? It's an exercise I give in my dynamics. It's really pretty cute. It's really neat. It's surprising. It's surprising. On a torus, of course, that's not true, but on a Klein bottle, it is. Because if A and B are not rationally related, you just fill up the old torus. So the point is, when they're not coupled, trajectories can be anywhere on here. What happens when they're coupled, as soon as you turn that coupling on, there's certain trajectories that everything wants to go to. Okay? And those are relative slow, that's phi. This point here is phi. Okay? So everything wants to go to that on the torus. So, now let's do one more simplification. Suppose we couple identical guys. Right? Hx and Hy are identical. Well, then what is this thing? This is h of minus phi minus h of phi. That's twice minus 2 times. That's equal to minus 2 epsilon h odd of phi. Right? It's just twice the odd part of h. Now, every odd periodic function has at least two fixed points. It has 0 and it has pi. So we know that there's two solutions at least to this, one like this and one like this. Okay? How do we know which ones are stable? Well, we find a fixed point. We differentiate it. We need minus 2 epsilon h prime of phi bar has to be less than 0, right? That's the definition, h odd. Okay, that would be that's what you need for stability, right? And so that just gives you h odd prime of phi bar has to be greater than 0. That's the condition for stability of a fixed point. So let's, in particular, what's the condition for stability of synchrony? H odd prime of 0 has to be positive. But that's the same as half of h prime of 0. Or that's the same as h prime of 0, right? Because the odd part plus the even part, by definition, the derivative of the even part at 0 is 0. So that's the same as, so for synchrony, the condition for stability for synchrony is this. Synchrony is stable if and only if h prime of 0 is greater than 0. All right? So now we can use our formula up here to figure out what that means biophysically. Okay? What's h prime of 0? H prime of 0 is just 1 over t, 0 to t, of s prime of t times, I'm going to call this whole schmear here, R of t. Bingo. Okay? So now, if we know what the response of the neuron is to a pulse, and we have a good model for the shape of a synapse, we can figure out very geometrically whether synchrony will be stable or not simply by looking at the area under this curve, this product of these two things. So let's say that R of t looks like this. Suppose R of t looks like this. Okay? Suppose R of t looks like that. And suppose that this is R of t. And suppose that S of t, synapse, goes up rapidly and then decays slowly. Okay? What's the derivative of that synapse look like? Well, the derivative of that synapse is big here. And then it rapidly, derivative is big, it rapidly crosses zero right there, and then it slowly comes back up, and it has to come back up here because it's periodic, it has to look like that. Okay, so that's what S prime looks like, and now you can see that the area is dominated by this negative part, right? And so you could see right away that synchrony would be unstable because H prime of zero would have to be negative. If you flip this around, like an inhibitory synapse, then H prime is positive. And that leads to this counterintuitive result that in some circumstances, inhibitory coupling can be stabilized synchrony. All right? So, and it really depends very crucially on the way, the shape of the synapse, okay? You can imagine synapses which have a delayed onset, which would give stable synchrony. There's all kinds of things you can play around with to get some intuition. But the bottom line is, this is sort of what you have to look at. This response times the derivative of your synapse. So there's the intuition. I mean, this analytic formula is bullshit. It can't, you know, you look at that and you say, what the hell? You try and explain that and you say, what the hell? You try and explain that to a biologist. You're screwed, okay? This way, at least they have some intuition, okay? And because a lot of biologists know what a phase response curve is or phase resetting curve, all right? So let me apply that to a very simple problem. All right, this is some experiment that was done by Scott Kelso. And you can do this yourselves if you're not a drummer. If you're a drummer, it doesn't work because drummers are too good. All right, tap an antiphase like this. Go faster and faster and faster. And eventually you'll switch to synchrony. You can't go fast synchronously. I mean, you can't maintain a high speed out of phase thing. All right. So Scott Kelso and Hermann Hocken. Hermann Hocken, Mr. Synergetics. Okay. It sounds like vitamins or something. But anyway. They suggested the following model for the phase difference between two oscillators. All right, let me write down the model here. Phi dot equals minus sine phi plus lambda sine 2 phi. Okay? And you can find that the solutions to this are phi equals 0. Two solutions to this are phi equals 0 and phi equals pi. And you can find that, and we're going to assume that lambda is less than 0. Okay? Lambda is less than 0. And it's easy to verify that 0 is asymptotically stable and pi is stable for lambda large enough in magnitude. Okay? In fact, okay? So lambda has to be, the derivative at pi is minus, is 1, 1 plus 2 lambda, okay? And so if lambda is negative and more negative than minus 1 half, then pi is stable. So Kelso and those guys said, okay, as I increase the frequency of the metronome, lambda gets smaller. So that was sort of their ad hoc model, and that will give you synchrony is stable and you lose stability pi of the out of phase state. Carl van Vrieswijk and Larry Abbott, who hates synchrony and oscillations, and I wrote a paper on this. Maybe that's why. You write a paper with me, you learn to hate the field. Larry and Carl and I wrote a paper in which we looked at coupling between integrate and fire neurons. And what we found is, as you change the time constant of the synapse, you get a very interesting bifurcation from synchrony to out of phase, or out of phase to synchrony. And you could do it for excitatory coupling or inhibitory coupling. Now, experimentally, it's pretty hard to change the time constant of the synapse. But if you have an oscillator and you have a synapse with a time constant, there's two time scales that you can think about: the frequency of the oscillation and the time constant of the limit cycle. The time constant of the synapse. So let's hold the time constant of the synapse constant and change the frequency of the oscillation. Okay? And if you do that, then here's the bifurcation diagram you get. With mutual excitatory coupling, you get this bifurcation diagram. Okay, here's what you get with mutual excitatory coupling. Synchrony is stable at low frequencies, and as the frequency goes up, synchrony becomes unstable, and there's an intermediate state which is not quite synchronous. The neurons are firing at out of phase with each other, but not 180 degrees out of phase. And then through a saddle node, through a pitchfork bifurcation, out of phase becomes stable. Never are both of them stable at the same time in the integrate and fire. And the transition from here to here is smooth, and you never see, and it's in the wrong direction. As frequency goes up, the out of phase becomes more stable. All right, that's with excitatory coupling. With inhibitory coupling, what we found with the integrate and fire was this. We found this picture. Integrate and fire has some weird properties, which is why this doesn't actually hook down here. Okay? We found this. As you increase the frequency, the out-of-phase solution, this is with inhibitory coupling, the out-of-phase solution becomes unstable through a subcritical bifurcation, and you have to flip the synchrony. Notice that it's bistable, because clearly we could tap our fingers synchronously if we want at any frequency, and out of phase, but it's much harder at high frequency. So this is sort of a phenomenon. This was a nice little ad hoc model, but you can take an integrate and fire. You can use the same. You don't have to use the integrate and fire. Same bifurcation diagram holds for the Traub model of excitatory cortical neuro. The same model. The same diagram holds basically for a large number of biophysical models as well. Okay, but the point is, you can understand this little thing just by this little argument. Kind of gives you an explanation for why things make the switch. Yes, sir.
Technical question: what rule do you have for your integrate and fire oscillators when one of them is brought through threshold by a spike you receive from another?
This is always the problem I have with integrate and fire models. And the reason I have that problem is exactly that. What rule do you use? Okay? Now, when we did our analysis, we're doing in the weak coupling limit. Epsilon goes to zero. So that's not an issue. Okay? However, when you're doing the simulations, it depends. A lot of people, if this guy is brought up, you immediately reset it, and you don't push it along phase at all. And that's the other objection I have with integrate and fire neurons, is there's certain things that don't make sense. Let me say another thing about the integrate and fire model, is the phase response curve is is not at all, doesn't look at all like cortical neurons because it has this big, I mean, for exactly your problem, you can always, the amount that you advance is independent of where you are in phase. And Strogatz and Marolo published a paper on integrating fire, large numbers of integrating fire, and they proved that synchrony, it always goes to synchrony. And that's because of this weird property that they have, that it doesn't matter whether where you are, how much you're advanced. You're advanced the same amount no matter what. Okay, and that's sort of a pathology because real neurons and real oscillators don't behave that way. Yes?
I've got another question, but it's something different. These are autonomous systems, but what if we put some current inside? I mean, if this would be like where we are very near to the limit cycle, but if we are driving the system with a current?
I don't know what you mean by putting current in.
Yeah, for example.
These things are oscillating maybe because you've injected current. I don't know. I don't know what you mean. I mean, this is a really simplified system.
I mean a function in time.
Oh, you mean if it's slowly varying in time and things like that. Of course, you can't use this. If it's slowly varying in time, then that's another kind of perturbation theory, and that you can analyze. But the equations are more complicated. But in terms of, again, this is the problem in general. If you want to do any kind of analysis, you're always stuck with this question about stationarity, all right? And the brain obviously isn't stationary. And so you can say, well, what good is all this crap? And it's perfectly legitimate objection, but you have to start somewhere when you do theory. Sure, it'd be great if you could do something with arbitrary nonlinear dynamics with arbitrary inputs, but you can't. So you do what you can. That's the only excuse I could offer. Okay. So, summarizing, you can understand a pair of coupled guys just by looking at the derivative of looking at the way the synapse interacts with this response function and averaging over the period. You can explain lots of really simple phenomena. Now, what can we say in general? What about general models like this, general coupled systems? Is there any kind of, I'll state what I think is a cute little theorem for a general system. Let's suppose we have theta j dot equals omega j plus h sub j of theta 1 minus theta j, theta n minus theta sub j. All right, so we have n of these equations. There's n guys all coupled together. Okay, they can have different frequencies and different coupling functions, but they're all coupled like this. And suppose that you have a phase-locked solution. So what's a phase-locked solution? A phase-locked solution is one such that theta sub j is equal to omega t plus phi sub j. Okay, where phi sub j is independent of time. And without loss of generality, we'll make phi sub 1 equal to 0, bro. Okay? Equal to 0. Okay? Because remember, you have this translation invariance, right? So we can always do everything relative to the phase of the first guy, right? So let's suppose we have a fixed point 0, phi 2 bar, phi n bar, comma omega, and omega. All right? That's the. Everybody's going at the same frequency because they're phase locked. Suppose we have a solution to that, all right? Then when is it stable? Well, we can give a sufficient condition for stability. Very simple sufficient condition for stability. All right? Suppose let A sub j k equal dH sub j d phi sub k evaluated at the fixed point, okay? Suppose that a sub jk is greater than or equal to 0, and a sub j, the matrix, is irreducible. All right, what the hell does that mean? It means that suppose I draw a line from every point, suppose I make a graph of nodes, n nodes, and I draw a line from node j to k if ajk is non-zero, okay? I draw a directed graph, okay? If I can get from anywhere to anywhere else following those lines, then the matrix is irreducible. All right, that's what it means. Just means everybody's connected to everybody can get to somebody eventually, all right, through a certain number of steps. So if it just means that this group of oscillators or this group of oscillators aren't separated from each other, that I always can talk to them. So if AJK is greater than or equal to zero and this matrix is irreducible, then fixed point is asymptotically stable. The very simple to verify. It's a great little theorem because it's so easy to pick out. It's very easy to pick it out. And you can't do better than this, much better than this. It's really hard to do better than this because you can always come up with exceptions. So it's sufficient, but it's not necessary. And for those of you who want to know how to prove it, it follows from the fifth most interesting theorem in applied math, the Gersh-Gorin circle theorem, a great theorem on stability of eigenvalues. Right up there with the Frobenius-Perron. There's like six or seven theorems that somebody should write down that everybody should know. Not everybody. I mean, obviously, your dog doesn't need to know that. My dog, the only theorem my dog cares about is one of these contraction, the ones on balls. Any theorem about balls is probably relevant to my dog. And discs and balls. All right. So now, what about, this is a general theorem, what about one-dimensional chains? Okay, and now let me give you another application now. Since you guys have eaten lunch, we can talk about intestines.
Okay. You need to show that the eigenvalues of that matrix are bounded above by...
Oh, here, you want to know the proof or something? Oh, for this, you want to show all the eigenvalues have negative real parts. And so it turns out what you do is you can show that the eigenvalues all sit on a series of circles, which are, if this holds, they all sit on here, which accumulate at the origin. So then what you have to, the irreducibility makes the origin here a simple eigenvalue.
But the largest eigenvalue has to be greater than...
Huh?
Doesn't the largest eigenvalue have to be positive?
Oh, on this? No. No, remember, I don't understand exactly what you're asking me.
It's a non-negative matrix, right? So that's the largest eigenvalue.
Oh, the linearization of this, well, this is a strictly non-negative matrix. That's right. So the Frobenius-Perron, you know the biggest eigenvalue is positive. But the linearization of this is related to something like negative this. Okay? But that you need a lot more than you need more because you need it really depends on the special structure of the linearization of this. The fact is the linearization of this looks like this. There's a bunch of positive crap here, and then in this along the diagonals it's negative all the crap that's in here. Okay? So then it follows immediately from this circle theorem. All right. Oh, that's right. I know you like linear algebra. You guys always do this linear algebra stuff. I got to teach graduate linear algebra in the fall, so this is good practice. Yes?
Yeah, I have a question about large groups of coupled oscillators. If you just have a few, then you get these tiny little kicks, and you essentially converge back to your limit cycle rather quickly. But if you have a lot of these little kicks accumulating, of course, in the limit is epsilon going to zero.
Yeah, well, that's right.
Okay,
there's the rub.
If epsilon is finite, you may have a problem, it seems. I mean, you could get kicked,
Well, in a sense, you have a problem sometimes, but on the other hand, the actual strength of, it's really hard to do much. You can't cause a neuron to spike pretty much with one synapse. You need lots of them. And I think, isn't that true, Mish? Except in some of these, escape things in jellyfish and stuff like that, like Agalantha or something. But I mean, again, this is again a very simplified setting. I'm looking in a very simplified setting, and your question is perfectly legitimate. What happens with large N? But let's suppose you have large N, but you're coupling sparse, so not everybody's coupled to everybody. Then you're still in a good, you're okay. All right, now let's do a chain, all right? I can do, is it okay if I do chains, Sebastian? All right, I'm losing you guys. Everybody's getting bored here. So should we take a break or not? No, let me wait a little bit longer before I take a break. All right, chains, intestines. That's how I got started in this whole oscillatory business, was intestines, all right? It's a really cool phenomena. If you rip out the intestines of any mammal, in particular, the rabbit, a loathsome creature. Rabbit is right down there with one of the worst creatures in the universe, as far as I'm concerned. Despicable. I had one as a pet. That was the great thing about going to Israel, is it died when I was in Israel. So I always will thank Israel for that. I came back, my wife left it in the cage, that was in June, and I came back, I couldn't get it out of the cage because it had swollen. We had to. You ever deflate a rabbit? It was really. That'll wake you up. And that'll wake you up. I trust me, man. It's better than any kind of ammonia. Deflating a one-day-old summarized rabbit is really. It works. Anyway, Bunny had lived a long life. Its name was Bunny. Isn't that clever? 6 years. That's pretty. I think that's pretty long for a rabbit, isn't it? 6 years. One of those big New Zealand whites. I won it at a carnival. I got a little ping pong ball in a glass. I didn't mean to. And they gave me this rabbit. It was a little cute thing. And my kid was there. Oh, yeah, I want the rabbit, Dad. You know, as you say, you get more flexible when you have kids, because otherwise I would, you know, stew. But so it got big. It got 8 pounds. 8 pounds. I had to spend $180 for cages and stuff for it. And untold, mean, you put your hand in there. It was like in Monty Python. Or you remember Jimmy Carter got attacked by a rabbit? Don't you remember that? There was a whole, there's pictures of it too. Anyway, my rabbit had to be related to that. Plus, I'm a gardener, and there's nothing worse except deer than rabbits. But the deer are afraid of the dog, but the rabbits aren't. Where were we? Intestines. All right, so you take the intestines out of a mammal, all right, and strip all the stuff off, and you're left with smooth muscle. And what you find is that if you cut the intestine into little discs, and you measure, there's oscillations, intrinsic oscillations, smooth muscle oscillations. And there's this nice linear frequency gradient, omega, as you go from the duodenum down to the ileum. I bet you guys didn't think you were going to learn all this intestinal physiology anyway. And in between there is the jejunum. Anyway, so as you go from here to here, there's this nice frequency gradient. All right, certain 20 cycles per minute or so, that's about the frequency of intestines. All right, this is in sliced up. In the intact intestine, what you find is things called frequency plateaus. Okay, so you find a big region where everybody's basically going at the same frequency, and then there are these jumps. Okay, so I got interested in coupled oscillators trying to explain that. And the simplest model that you can come up with is the following. Theta sub j dot equals omega sub j plus sine theta j plus 1 minus theta j plus sine theta j minus 1 minus theta j. All right, that's the nearest neighbor sine model. Okay? So everybody's coupled to only their nearest neighbors with a sinusoidal coupling. And we'll put a linear gradient in here. We'll put a linear gradient in here. Beta sub j. Okay? So beta is a linear gradient. Now, it turns out that, let me put an aside, that roughly the same time we were thinking about intestines, this is Nancy Capel and I, Avis Cohen and Phil Holmes were thinking about lamprey. Does everybody here know what a lamprey is? It's this sort of this eel-like creature that sucks fish. Not humans. It's not like the leech. Okay, they're really cool. If you've ever seen one, if you go to a tank, a lamprey, I mean, if you go to a tank, like Avis Cohen has a tank in her lab, she throws these perch in there, all right? And within, you know, a couple of hours, there's hundreds of these little lampreys hanging on the end of the perch. It looked like a Rastafarian. And then after a day or so, the perch would change from its normal nice pale green to a white perch because it was exsanguinated. Isn't that I love that word. Exsanguinated. They suck the fish blood right out of it. And then they all leave it and the old fish floats up there. But, anyway, lampreys are disgusting, but you get attached to them. In any case. in any event, see, this time in the afternoon, you really have to start the jokes more frequently to keep you guys awake. Also to keep me awake. All right, so we're looking for phase locking here in a linear frequency gradient. Avis Cohen and Phil Holmes have the same idea. They have essentially the same model. Now, I'll leave this as an exercise. They were trying to explain, here's the deal with the lamprey. Take the cord out of the lamprey, lamprey spinal cord, and you put it in a dish with glutamate in it. Glutamate's an excitatory neurotransmitter. Turns out that if you stick electrodes in that lamprey, you get these very nice regular oscillations, and they come in the form of a wave that goes from rostral to caudal, okay? You get this nice traveling wave. And there's this nice phase lag between successive segments. Okay? And that's the central pattern generator that controls the swimming of the lamprey. Right? So if you put the muscles back on there, it's sending signals for the thing to swim. Okay? So they came up with the same idea. Probably Phil came up with this because he's a mathematician, and mathematicians always come up with this model. All right? I'll leave it as an exercise for the reader. So what we do is you define psi sub j equal theta j plus 1 minus theta sub j. Sine sub j is successive phase differences. All right, and what you can find is that sine of psi sub j is equal to beta j n minus j over 2. All right. I might be off by a factor of 2 here or something like that. But this is roughly what you find. So therefore, you can find a phase lock solution to this if and only if this quantity is less than 1 in magnitude. All right? Otherwise, you can't. And of course, that says that this thing is really hard to synchronize with any kind of gradient, because the biggest gradient this can support is O of 1 over n, because what's the maximum of this? The maximum of this is O of 1 over n squared, sorry. The maximum of this is n squared over 4, right? Happens at n equals to n over 2, all right? So that you need beta n squared over 4 to be less than 1, that means that the gradient that you can support is 4 over n squared. That's terrible, right? And to be fair, you might, you know, divide this by n, but it's still a really infinitesimal gradient. It really stinks. Furthermore, if you plot the phase lags here, they're non-monotonic, okay? They go up and go down, right? They're biggest in J in the middle and small at the ends, okay? The intersegmental lags. All right, that's fine for the intestine. And what Nancy Capel and I proved is that as you cross this thing, all right, you have the phase locked case, which looks like this. This is the phase locked case. It actually goes at the average frequency of one end to the other, okay? And as you increase the frequency gradient, okay, then this breaks into two pieces like this, and so you can explain frequency plateaus. All right, and this was incredibly ornate mathematics. It was probably about 30 pages of of math to prove this, because this is a global dynamical system. But I don't want to get into all that, because it's irrelevant to neuroscience. Okay, but it turns out that this sine model is really not a very good model for the lamprey. And the reason it's not a very good model for the lamprey is A, there's no evidence experimentally for a frequency gradient in the lamprey. Two, the intersegmental phase lag is constant. It's pretty much independent of where you are in the lamprey. Here, psi sub j would be the lag between two successive segments. That's definitely not monotonic. I mean, not constant, right? It goes all over, it goes up and goes down. All right, everybody see that? Because this function's a quadratic. Okay? So, those are the two bad things about this model for the lamprey. It was a good start, and it gives you waves and stuff, but it doesn't give you quite the right kind of waves, and there's no evidence for a frequency gradient. So, how can you get waves without the frequency gradient? So, what Nancy and I looked at, and other people looked at, was the following model. Since there's no evidence for any kind of any kind of systematic frequency difference along the things, let's look at this model. Oh, okay. Well, here, let's just suppose psi j looks like this, okay? Forget the sign. Make beta small, okay? So so psi sub j is, so here, we'll think of it this way, Herman. Let's go to the continuum limit for a moment, okay? Psi of x is beta x squared over, beta x squared or something like that, okay? So that's the derivative of the phase gradient. So what is the actual phase? You integrate that, and it's beta x cubed over 3. Okay? So that means that if you plot theta of x as a function of x, it's a cubic type thing. Alright? So, alright, maybe I have the sign. Alright, so this guy is going to fire for, these guys, maybe I've drawn it backwards. So, can't draw a cubic. All right, so these guys are firing way ahead. Now you see the waves, so it's going fast and then slow and then fast. Okay, got it? Okay, good. Now you see the wave. Oh, that's right, you love waves. Yeah. I like waves too. I mean, flag waving now, huh? All right, so let's take this chain, all right? But we aren't going to make any assumptions a priori about these guys being purely odd functions. Because by making that assumption, this is a very, mathematicians love the word non-generic, okay? What non-generic means is that if I throw this chalk up in the air, it's going to land exactly on this spot. That would be non-generic, okay? So that's generic. It didn't land on that particular spot. All right. Odd functions in the space of all functions are that spot. Okay. So in your general model that you're going to pull off the shelf from any kind of neural oscillator or anything, you're not going to get an odd interaction function unless you've got some very special symmetries built in. All right. So, let's suppose that these are not purely odd functions, but they have some even component. All right? Then what Nancy and I proved is as n goes to infinity, as this chain gets longer and longer and longer, okay, then the solutions to this approach the solutions to a particular two-point boundary value problem. So let me state it this way. We're looking for phase-locked solutions to this. We're looking for solutions which all these guys got the same frequency. Okay? Omega equals, that's the bulk frequency, plus h plus of phi sub j plus h, or psi sub j, minus psi sub j minus 1. Okay? Remember, psi sub j was theta j plus 1 minus theta j. Right? So we're looking for solutions to this. This is going to be valid for j equals 2 to n minus 1. We also have the additional condition. Okay, so those are the conditions at the other ends, right? Because you only have, at the end, you don't have anybody else to couple to. All right, so this equation, looking for phase lock solutions, are equivalent to this equation. Okay, everybody see that? What Nancy and I showed is that as n goes to infinity, the solutions to this approach the solutions to a two-point singularly perturbed boundary value problem. They approach the solutions to this. I won't write it down here with some other term here, and then all right, so that's a singularly perturbed problem because as n gets bigger and bigger and bigger, this involves a second derivative here. All right, so it looks like this. So we showed that you could do that. And the neat thing about this is this boundary value problem can be completely analyzed. All right, you can completely analyze it. And let me give you the bottom line. All right, if h plus equals h minus, in other words, it's isotropic. The medium's isotropic. Coupling's the same this way as this way. The solutions to this look like this. This is what the phase gradient looks like. Okay, phase gradient, all right, looks like this. Or like this. Or the thing flipped up. It depends on the details of the model. It either looks like that, like that. Okay? The point is that what does this correspond to? It corresponds to waves going this direction in this end and this direction in the other end and colliding in the middle, or this one corresponds to waves originating in the center and moving outward. Okay? That's not at all what you see in the lamprey. All right? You see waves going in only one direction the whole way down. All right? So this is only in the purely isotropic case. As soon as it becomes anisotropic, this boundary layer goes over to one end or the other. All right? And let's suppose it goes over this way. Then you basically have the lamprey. You have a constant phase lag. It's independent of where you are. And the waves are going this way. And there's no frequency gradient. You get just nice waves. You just get these funny little boundary layers. Thelma Williams and Karen Sigvard cut lamprey cords and measured very carefully phase lags after healing occurred. They found evidence for boundary layers, big changes in the frequency at the edges. We made a bunch of other predictions. For example, if you take the lamprey and you leave some of the muscle on the ends of it, then that muscle has sensors in it that are sensitive to stress. And you can move that muscle. There are stretch receptors. Okay, and you can move that and periodically entrain the cord. Okay, and it turns out that if you assume anisotropy, the behavior of trying to force it caudally is going to be different than trying to force it rostrally. Okay, rostral is head, caudal is tail. Okay, and what we found is we made some predictions about what the range of frequencies in which you could entrain it would be. No matter what the model was, as long as it obeyed certain rather generic hypotheses. And lo and behold, they do the experiments and exactly pointed that out. Another experiment you can do to test these ideas is you can put the lamprey cord in a bath with which is sealed in the middle and has one concentration of glutamate here and another one here. And that's equivalent to having half the quarter, one frequency and half at another frequency. Again, you can make all kinds of predictions and it works out. All right, so the point is that this simple idea of weakly coupled oscillators in a chain turned out to be a very powerful way of analyzing stuff without knowing the details of the biophysics of these chains. Yes?
Would that be the prediction about the age, the connection, means in terms of...
Oh, very good question. You set me up perfectly. You could be my straight man. Or straight woman? I don't know. Straight person. All right, here it is. All right, what the theory did was saying something about the effective strength of connections one way versus the other. Okay, and it surprised us, I think, at first, and then we got thinking in retrospect, that the coupling was stronger from the tail up than the head down. Okay, that's what we concluded based on this. All right, and that's also what the experiments seem to be indicating. Now, from an ethological point of view, that makes sense because if you look at the way a lamprey swims, almost all of the force generated by the swimming lamprey is occurring down at the tail end because it's really stiff up by, it's much stiffer. There's not much compliance there, so all the force is there, so it's more important to know what the tail's doing than what the... It's more important for the head to know what the tail's doing than the other way around. And there's been recent experiments using this stuff called dye they inject in there that seem to indicate that there's more connections up this way than the other way. And there's some other stuff that they did on healing and various and sundry things, but the lamprey story's pretty much been abandoned now because Karen's off doing Parkinson's, I don't know what Thelma's doing, and Nancy's doing cortex. So and so nobody's doing the lamprey anymore. So did that answer your question or not? Sort of, okay. All right, now's a good time, I think, to take a break. Is that okay, Sebastian? So how long a break do you want to take?
20 minutes.
So I'll see you at 10 of 4, if you're still coming back. And there I'll talk about averaging and neural networks, okay? Let me say a few words, a few more words about. Let me say just a few more words about weakly coupled oscillators in two dimensions. All right, two dimensions are so cool, and you can get so many cool patterns. Anybody wants to after lecture come up? I have a simulation program that you can change a few parameters. You get these really cool pictures. I mean, you know, all these snakes eating each other and stuff, the particles moving around. It's really amazing. All right, this is just with nearest neighbor interactions between oscillators. So let's consider a square array or something like that. With coupling like this, can we say anything about this? I mean, what can we say about, and let's suppose the coupling is only north, south, east, and west. Okay, let's just make it really simple, really stupid, simply this. Okay, can we say anything about this? Okay, I had this really smart Chinese student a couple years ago, Li Wei Ren, and what he proved was really clever. He proved that the solution, that one solution to this is you take the solution to a one-dimensional chain this way, and you take a solution to, well, the one-dimensional chain this way, and you essentially take the cross product of that, and that gives you the solution to this. In other words, you can decompose it into the product of two. That's assuming, like, everybody's, you know, they're anisotropic, but it's the same everywhere. okay, the same kind of anisotropy. Okay, so that's one sort of solution. And so in particular, what you could do with that is you could get solutions that look like target waves, all right? Without any kind of frequency, without any kind of frequency differences, simply by assuming, with a completely isotropic coupling with no frequency differences, you could get, but as long as you had some non-odd components in your interaction function, you could get solutions that look like this. Even though you have a square array, you get perfectly circular waves. Okay, so you could get that. Another kind of solution you could get is diamond waves. All right, so you can get solutions that look like this, where the relative phases sort of are it's linear along things, and then there are these sort of places where it crashes into each other. And again, afterwards, if anybody wants to see these, I can show you there's just a whole panoply of really cool waves you can get. All right, so these are all, you can think of these as trivial, if you're a mathematician, this is just a trivial homotopy of the synchronous solution. All right, these things directly connect to the synchronous branch as you change some parameter. All right, are there other solutions to this? Well, I had another, my first PhD student, Joe Paulette, and I looked at the case with a sine model, sinusoidal coupling, nearest neighbors, only in this direction, isotropic. And what we were able to prove is that there existed, in addition to the synchronous solution, which was asymptotically stable, there existed a stable, asymptotically stable rotating wave. All right? And which is sort of relevant because if you look at turtle cortex and the looming stimulus, Dave Kleinfeld's done some neat stuff on that, and they find transient rotating waves. And there's some really old stuff by Helmut Petsch in the early 70s, Petsch and Rappelsberger on epilepsy in rabbit cortex. One fewer rabbit in the world. You dump penicillin on the rabbit is unique in that it has the largest area of flat brain. Not surprising for an animal of that low intelligence. If you dump penicillin on that, which is an epileptic agent, you can get acute epilepsy. And he did a 4x4 array, and he finds nice rotating waves there as well. So it's relevant to that. And I'll leave this as an exercise for you guys for the 4x4. Okay? This is fun, and you should be able to prove it. Don't worry, I'm not going to grade any of these. Okay? What I'm going to plot for you here is I'm going to plot the exact phases for a 4x4 array with coupling that's only dependent on your four neighbors. So you only have two neighbors here, this guy and this guy. Here you have three neighbors, okay? And all the other places you have four. And the coupling sine of the phase difference, okay? Here's the answer here. 0, pi over 2, pi over 2, pi, 3 pi over 2, 0, 3 pi over 2, pi, x, pi over 2 minus x, pi over 2 plus x, pi minus x, pi plus x, 3 pi over 2 minus x, 3 pi over 2 plus x, and 2 pi minus x, which is the same as minus x, of course. Okay, so what you should do is I'll give it to you as an exercise, prove that this is a solution to the 4x4 array with nearest neighbor coupling, and figure out what x is, what the value of x is. Okay? So that's an exercise. All right? And that's and it follows from that theorem I told you a while ago, general stability theorem. It turns out that this is asymptotically stable. Yeah. So not only do we have existence of rotating waves, but we have stability of them. You know, I don't know of any PDE reaction diffusion examples where they have existence and stability of rotating waves. There's been lots of rotating waves that have been proven asymptotically and stuff, but nobody's actually done the stability and stuff. This is one of the cases where you can do that. You can prove it for a 2n by 2n array, okay, with any odd function, any odd interaction function. What happens with non-odd interaction functions is really cool. And again, I'll show you that. What happens is these rotating waves, you can think of these rotating waves as being completely straight-armed, okay? So that the wave just rotates around. What happens as you start to add non-odd components to this is these become curved and you get spiral waves. You get nice, really nice rotating spiral waves. Okay? And as you continue to do that, the spiral waves get tighter and tighter and they become unstable in the center. And you start to get the core oscillating, meandering cores, which you see in experimental stuff in these reaction diffusion equations. Furthermore, as you continue to go, the core moves chaotically all over the domain. If it ever falls off, then synchrony comes on and that's all you're left with. Okay? So you get all kinds of cool stuff with these models. All right. So that's all I want to say. I'm going to say about 2D. What about beyond nearest neighbor? I mean, what about beyond? Well, there's, you can ask questions about beyond nearest neighbor coupling. Nancy and Lei Zhang and I proved a bunch of stuff about non-nearest neighbor coupling. Li Wei Ren also proved a bunch of stuff about non-nearest neighbor coupling in chains. In 2D things, who knows? I think it's an open problem what happens. There's stuff you can do on rings. Rings are much easier because there's no boundary of conditions. Okay, but rings are kind of fake from a biological point of view. The brain, well, a lot of people use circular reasoning, so I guess it's not surprising that you could use a ring geometry. Let me say something beyond weak coupling. Paul Breslov has done some really nice work on integrating fire models, all right? Everybody knows the integrating fire model. So here's sort of the integrating fire model that Paul's worked on. All right, so there's an integrating fire model. It may not be completely familiar to you. All right, T sub j is the nth time the neuron fires, okay? And it fires whenever it hits threshold, which is 1. All right, so these neurons hit threshold, bang, bang, bang. All right, this is the reset. Notice I just put it as a delta function. Every time the neuron hits 1, it gets pulled back down to 0, okay? That's the idea of a reset. Right, and you can make this reset some other number. It doesn't have to be 1, okay? Depends on how you do your model. All right? And these are like alpha functions or whatever, your standard synapse type functions, t, e to the minus t, or anything like that. So what you can do with this model is you can integrate it. Pardon me. You can integrate this, okay? And you end up with an equation that looks like this. Vj of t is equal to minus some constant here times sum over n e to the minus t minus t sub j n, okay? That's just the reset condition. And then plus sum over k n beta kj t minus t sub kn. Okay? So that's just integrating it. This is just the convolution of the exponential with the alpha function. That's all this is, right? You just integrate it. You guys can do that. That's sort of sophomore or junior level linear differential equations. All right, so there's probably a j in here too, and I've somehow forgotten the I. I don't know where that is. So look, drop the J here to make it easy. All right, so there you get the nice integrating fire model. And, oh, I guess there is a bias current here. Well, I haven't integrated this completely right. Yeah, I guess this is right. There you go. All right, so I sub J. I guess that shows up. Yeah. All right. Yeah, that's right. So now, and this doesn't have a J. Whoa, what is that? just some sort of car or something. It sounded like one of those little model airplanes. We used to make those and put explosives in them and stuff, and then drop them on stuff. Did you ever do that? Or make rockets with the warheads in them? You ever do that? You guys? No. No. You can't get good chemistry sets anymore anyway. Anyway, so this is the integrated form. And there's a whole class of models that people look at where these are more general. Von Hammett and Gerstner and stuff. It's called the spike response model. All right, and the idea is Vj of t, what you're interested in is by definition, Vj of tj sub n is equal to 1, okay? That's the that defines the firing time. So when it hits 1 and then it gets reset, all right? And I should write a plus on all these things, okay? So if t is less than t sub jn, this is 0, all right? You don't have any term at all. All right, there's really a heavy side step on you. All right, anyway, so what the idea is if you look for phase lock solutions to this, you're looking for solutions of the form T sub Jn equals Nt plus, right? So that would be a periodic solution. It fires every capital T times. All right, and with relative phases here. If you plug that in here, then you end up with 1 equals I sub j minus a sum over n e to the minus nt minus t sub j hat. You get something in here. I can't ever remember what you put in here. Plus, but it's independent of t. It's just n. It just depends on n. Something like this. I guess you get something like that. All right? Plus sum over k of beta sub jk of tk minus tj hat. And I'll put an n in here, or put a T in here, capital T, because you're summing over some exponentials that depend on period T. So T appears explicitly in here, the period. All right? So basically, you end up, this is just a function of T. And these are functions of T. Okay? So you end up with a function of T here, function of T here. And this, and you had to solve this implicitly defined function. But you'll notice that this looks very much like that. The difference is that this interaction function doesn't depend on the frequency at all, the period. So that makes this problem quite a bit easier to do than this. However, the structure of these problems is very similar. And as a consequence, so I really, let me make this more explicit. Semicolon capital T. If you knew what T was, this function would look exact. This thing would look exactly like this. And what Breslov has done is taken all the theorems that Capel and I have done on the two-point boundary value problem stuff and all those limits and all that stuff. And he's shown, he and Steve Coombs and some other students of his have shown that the same thing holds with this model. Okay? So the point is that you can do integrate and fire in the same manner as you did the weak coupling. And formally, the equations look the same. Yes?
Question, we do convolution on I.
Huh?
Did we do convolution,
ij? Ij is just a constant. So when you integrate it, it's still a constant. Okay, it's just, you know, here, if you wanted to, you know. What's the solution of that? V of t equals V of 0 e to the minus t plus e to the minus t times the integral 0 to t e to the s f of s ds. okay? Right, that's the solution to this thing. And now what you end up doing, I guess this probably has some exponential stuff in it. It might be 1 minus, there might be a 1 minus e to the minus t in here. Okay, but you're interested as t goes to infinity, what happens, and so that goes away and you're just left with this thing, right? Because you're interested in asymptotic stuff. All right, so that's, so the bottom line is that the integrating fire looks just like the phase model, even though it's a little more complicated because this thing is implicitly dependent on time, on period. All right, so that's all I want to say about weak coupling, phase models, and integrating fire. Now I want to turn to, I was going to do that, but I won't do that. All right, let's do averaging, because averaging is more fun. Not more fun, but the waves are cooler. But let me do reduction to neural networks, because I promised I would do that. Of course, Sebastian's not here, so he can't call me on it. He told me he already did this. But, oh, you are here. You can call me. Okay, so let me do that. All right. Well, I want to do it anyway, because it's easier to explain. It's easy to explain. It's late in the day. If anybody has any wine they can lend me, I could go on longer with pride with alcohol. Okay. All right. So now what I want to do is I want to talk about neural oscillators. I mean, I want to talk about coupling biophysical models synaptically. All right. And again, there's always some, it's as Rosanna Dana always used to say, there's always something, okay? And here, I'm going to have an epsilon. You always have to have an epsilon. If you don't have an epsilon, you're screwed, okay? So here's the equations I'm going to look at. C, I'm going to start with a one population model, all right? C dvj dt equals minus, well, I can write, I sub j minus I ionic, sub j, v sub j, all your other ionic variables, I don't care. Okay, now comes the fun part, minus sum over k, g j k, s sub k, times v sub j minus e reversal. Okay, so there's a differential equation coupling a whole bunch of guys together with synapses. The synaptic strength is GJK between each one. It's conductance, okay? This makes sense. And now I have to write down the equations for this. ds sub JDT equals, here's my big caveat, epsilon times alpha of V sub J 1 minus S sub J minus S sub J. Okay? Everybody got it? So these are slow synapses. I know real synapses are fast, but bear with me, because I'm going to get you neural networks. And I know everybody likes neural networks, right? Because you can do hop field stuff on them. All right? So here's the differential equation, and epsilon is a small parameter. So what can we do with this? This looks pretty hopeless because it's, you know, a large dimensional system. However, it's not, and the reason is because epsilon is small. So if epsilon's small, then you expect S sub J to not change much. Right? Everybody buy that? If epsilon is small, ds sub j dt is small. So S is pretty much constant, okay, for short periods of time. So let's treat it as a constant. Right? If it's a constant, then this is just some big parameter. All right. So I'm going to call this thing right here g sub j. Okay? So g sub j is the total conductance felt from all the synapses on the jth neuron. And it's almost constant because epsilon is small. It's not changing much. So now we've now got a series of decoupled problems, because this is just a parameter. So we have C dvj dt equals I sub j minus I sub ionic minus g sub j times v minus v reversal. Let's plot the bifurcation diagram of this as a function of g sub j. All right, what does it look like? Let's suppose that it's an excitatory synapse. All right, so it's like injecting current. And furthermore, let's suppose that the neurons are class 1 excitable. That is to say, the neurons have that saddle node limit cycle behavior. All right? So the way that repetitive firing occurs is this model. Remember that model? Not the homoclinic, but the periodic orbit on a circle. All right? Remember the fixed point on the circle. Okay, so I'm going to assume that. So what does that mean? G looks. What does the voltage look like? The potential, as a function of G. I'm going to drop the J's for now. What does this look like? For low conductances, nothing happens, and then you lose the existence of this extra fixed point, and you have a periodic orbit that occurs out here. All right, and now you have a series of periodic orbits. Okay? Everybody got it? And this is, these neurons are spiking away, all right? But they spike at higher and higher frequencies. All right, everybody got it? All right, so there we go. This is the bifurcation diagram as a function of G. So now we have two kinds of behaviors. If G is less than G star, and G star sub J, and that, of course, depends on the bias current, whatever that bias current is, right? So if G is less than that, the neurons go to this low fixed point, all right? If they're at a fixed point, what are the synapses doing? If I'm not firing, my synapse isn't going to do anything, okay? So the idea is that if alpha of V is equal to zero, if V is at a fixed point, right? The synapse doesn't turn on. Remember, the synapses, biologically, what happens? All right, this neuron fires at the soma. There's an action potential that shoots down the axon, okay? Invades the synapse, okay? This then opens a bunch of L-type calcium channels. These L-type calcium channels cause release of transmitter and dump things out. L-type calcium channels, remember, are high threshold. So if this neuron doesn't fire, no transmitter is released here, no synapse turns on. All right? So that's the bottom line. Alpha of V is zero down here. So alpha of V equals zero. What about out here? Well, out here, the neuron's firing repetitively. Right? All right? Going repetitively. So what do we have? We have, this is now a periodic function of time, right? Right? Because, periodic function of time, because the neuron fires repetitively. Okay? So now we are in position to use the averaging theorem. All right, now those of you who are sharp or are not completely asleep yet will say, ah, professor, what happens around here? We ignore it. You know, see no evil, hear no evil, we speak not of it, okay? So forget it. Formally, the theory is completely wrong around there, because no matter how small you make epsilon, as you get closer and closer here, the period can be arbitrarily low, arbitrarily long, and therefore the averaging theorem breaks down. However, it turns out in practice that never makes much of a difference. Okay? So there's my... Whoa, sorry. Okay? So, what happens around here? Well, let's suppose we're in the periodic regime, then we average this. Well, the average of that doesn't matter. This is independent. So really all we have to do is worry about average of V sub j of t, right? And that's equal to 1 over t, and that depends on g sub j, right? Right, the period depends on g sub j, times the integral from 0 to t of g sub j, alpha of V of t, semicolon g sub j, dt. All right, everybody see that? That's just averaging over the thing. Yes, sir?
Why wouldn't you use this technique for class 2 oscillations where there's the frequency doesn't vary much?
Why can't you use it?
Yeah.
Because you have the problem of, in class 2, there's two ways you could look at it. In class 2, you could think about the subcritical hop case, okay? But then there's a problem of which branch do you choose, okay? It's no longer one-to-one. It's not invertible, okay? See, here, it's monotone. There's no choice, okay? So that you have a two-valued function, so it's not a proper function, okay? Do you see what I mean? Okay? Or you might say, well, what about the supercritical hop bifurcation? Okay? Well, the trouble with the supercritical hop bifurcation is that things are bad things, you can't use it near here because it's not a robust point, okay? So you're screwed no matter what, all right? That's the bottom line. However, these ways are harder to dismiss than this part. And so I use this. Furthermore, this makes a nice function. All right? And you'll see in just a second how nice it really is. All right. Let's think about a neuron from a biological point of view that's injected with current. All right? Its frequency is changing as we inject current. If you look at the spike width, though, the spike width doesn't really much matter in most neural models. Spike width is always 1 or 2 milliseconds, and the period is determined by the recovery phase. Okay? Do you buy that or not? Okay, I got a bridge. It is true. It's pretty true. The spike width doesn't much matter. If the spike width doesn't much matter, and the only time alpha is non-zero is during the spike width, then this thing is just equal to 1 over t of g sub j times a constant, c, that's independent of g sub j because this integral is 0, the integrand is 0 everywhere except during the spike. The spike width is pretty much constant, and so it doesn't matter what you integrate over. Okay? You see what I mean? If I have a function that looks like that, it doesn't matter if I integrate from here to here, or here to here, or here to here. It doesn't matter, right? Okay? So this is just a constant over t of g sub j. But what is t of g sub j? That's the period. What is 1 over that? The firing rate, right? So what is this average? It's the firing rate of the neuron. If the neuron's not firing, the firing rate is 0. And otherwise, it's the firing rate of the neuron. So what do we have? We have reduced this biophysical model to this equation. S sub j dt equals epsilon times f of g sub j times 1 minus s sub j minus s sub j. And g sub j is just sum gjk s sub k, right? So what do we have? If we absorb epsilon into t, rescale time, we have s sub j dt equals nonlinear function of sum gjk s sub k, 1 minus s sub j minus s sub j. We have a neural network model. The only thing that makes it look a little bit different from the classical neural network models is this presence of this 1 minus s sub j. But if you go and look in the literature in 1972 at Jack Cowan and Hugh Wilson's original paper in, I think it was in Biophysical Journal, okay? If you look at that paper, they have this term in their model. They derive it from a completely different manner. It has to do with the refractory period of the neuron, okay? But it shows up. So that we really basically come back to deriving that equation from the biophysics. Now, what is the upside of this is that these functions can be explicitly figured out in terms of the ionic model. All the parameters, all the coefficients. Okay? So you can, if you want to try and get some sort of behavior, and I believe Sebastian used a technique similar to this. What they were trying to do is they were trying to make a line attractor, I think, in their ocular motor thing. Is that right? In the goldfish, right? They put these rigs on the little tiny fish's head, okay? Don't you put a little rig on the head or something? Little. Well, goldfish are stupid anyway. I won't carp about that. No, that's a joke, get it? In order to get a firing, a spiking model to do a line attractor, what Sebastian did was first do this to get it down into this kind of model, and then they fit parameters to do that, and then they took it back, mapped it back up to here in order to get a spiking model. Is that right? It's pretty much right, right? There were some subtleties that are a little bit different, but it's pretty much the same idea. Okay? So bottom line is we get this model. This is a firing rate model, sort of, but it's not really a firing, this is not a firing rate, this is the amount of synaptic conductance, or the probability of a synapse being open. Okay? So you can get this kind of model. You can do the same thing with populations of excitatory and inhibitory, except that this term's a little more complicated in here. All right? So I think this is cool. This is really cool. And so I want to devote the rest of the time, if that's okay, to talking a little bit about firing rate models, or don't you want to hear about them? You guys have heard everything about them or not? Did you guys do the Amari stuff?
Larry did it. Larry did a little bit of it, but didn't take any details.
Okay, well let me do the... I'm sorry, what?
I did winner take all, but I didn't do the
Okay, let me do a little bit. Is that okay if I talk about... You know, I started in this field in neural networks. That was my.
Epsilon being very small, function means then that S changes very slowly. So
means that what?
The firing rate changes very slowly. I mean, if epsilon is very small, what is isn't that a restriction on your neural network?
Oh yeah, it's absolutely. I mean, but as I said, there's always something. I had weak coupling before, I had relaxation dynamics before, I have homogeneity, I have isotropy, I make all kinds of assumptions. Because I get paid to prove theorems, not simulate stuff. I'm kidding. They don't pay me to simulate, they pay me by the theorem. You get $2 for this theorem and $10 for this theorem. So that my salary depends on that. So I have to simplify things, otherwise I can't prove anything. See, it's a different culture. I'm kidding. But anyway, let me talk a little bit about neural networks, unless you don't want to hear about neural networks. You want to hear about waves or something else? All right, well, let me talk a little bit about neural networks, okay? So let's do the other thing that mathematicians always do. We'll go to the continuum limit right now, all right? And we'll assume that the coupling function is a function of J minus K, and we'll go to the continuum limit. So we have the following model. ds dt equals f of the integral over of g of x minus y, s of y, dy. All right, there we go. Neural network model, continuum neural network model. So what are some case scenarios that one can look at? one thing that people are interested in is traveling waves, wave fronts, okay? So one thing you might look for is a traveling wave. Another thing people are interested in is working memory. You guys probably heard about working memory. There's a big industry in that. There was even a whole conference in where was it? The one in Cold Spring Harbor. Was that Banbury or something? Yeah. There's a whole industry in working memory models. The idea is to try and construct models where you have localized regions of high activity, okay, surrounded by stuff that isn't a island of activity in a sea, solitons or something, they have names for them in physics too. All right, so I'm going to construct those for a particular class of models, and I'm also going to talk about traveling waves. So let me start with the traveling waves first. All right, let's do the usual thing here. I'm going to go from minus infinity to infinity. All right, and I'm going to assume a strictly excitatory coupling. Now, g of x is something like a Gaussian or something like that, and symmetric. Okay. And without loss of generality, finally I can make it completely without loss of generality. I'm going to assume g is positive, non-negative, and without loss of generality, the integral from minus infinity to infinity, g of x dx is 1. Okay? So, what am I going to assume? Let's look at this. 0 equals f of s 1 minus s minus s. Oh, what does f of s look like? F of s is a firing rate, so it's going to be it's going to be 0 for a while because the neuron's not firing, and then it's going to go up monotonically, okay? So you can think of f looking like that, all right? So let's look at this thing. What does this look like? Well, if f is sharp enough or strong enough or nonlinear enough, then this will have 3 fixed points, all right? It'll have a fixed point at 0. It'll have a fixed point at S1 and a fixed point at S2, okay? And they'll be ordered like this. And this one will be an unstable fixed point, and this is a stable fixed point. So if you plot this function in the phase plane, plot this function, Q of S, function of S, it looks like this, right? 3 fixed points, okay? So those of you who are reaction diffusion guys know that if you take a system with 3 fixed points and you couple them up diffusively, then you can expect to find traveling waves that take you from one state, one stable state, to another stable state. These are traveling fronts. What does it correspond to in the original model? It corresponds to shocking the slice, having the neurons fire and propagate the firing across there. All right, to connect it to something biological, if you take a slice of cortex out of a rat or something like that, and you put it in a dish to make a cortical slice preparation, and you dump in BMI, bicuculin methiodide, that blocks GABA, that blocks inhibition, then you're in a situation where you have only excitatory coupling. If you shock that piece of cortex, you get a wave that propagates across. Now, it's not a wave front, it's a wave pulse, okay? And the reason that it's not a wave front is because things get tired after they fire a while. So you can think of this as the first order approximation of that, because you're spreading excitation, but there's no process to cause recovery, all right? So it bears the same relationship to traveling waves in the Fitzy-Nagumo equation that the fronts do. If you've ever looked at the analysis of that, the way people analyze traveling waves in the Fitzy-Nagumo equations is they look at the singular limit when the recovery variable is slow, and you have a front that joins the downstate to the upstate and a front that joins the upstate to the downstate, and you glue them together to get a pulse. You can think of this as the same analogous thing. We could put a slow AHP current or something like this in here, calcium-dependent potassium current or something like that. And then this equation has another variable which kills the wave once it starts, kills the front and makes it a pulse. All right, but I don't want to go into that. Let's just talk about the front. Okay, suppose that this is true, and suppose that F prime of 0 is less than 0, F prime of S2 is less than 0, and F prime of S1, or not F prime, Q. Q prime of S1 is positive. In other words, you have two stable fixed points and one unstable, so you have exactly this picture. Then it's an astonishing theorem, I think. I think this is an amazing result. It's due to Xinfu Chen, who's a brilliant applied analyst. The theorem is, suppose that G is, you know, like a Gaussian or something like that, then there exists a unique traveling front for this that joins this fixed point to this fixed point. It's unique and it's asymptotically stable. Okay, so you don't make any assumptions on F other than that this function looks like this. It's such a general result, and it's so intuitively appealing. Okay, so it says basically, no matter what you do, you're going to get a front. So you can go back to the biophysical model and verify it numerically, and you find a nice front and leaves all these oscillations in its wake. Okay? Huh? It doesn't have to be monotonic, in fact, but in practice it usually is. But you just need this picture. There's one or two weird technical assumptions that are always true. But anyway, it's a really great theorem. It's buried in a really obscure math journal that you'll never read because it's pages and pages of proof. All right, but we'll use it. All right, that's the beauty of theorems. You can use them. It's not like biology results, right? You can't use them because they're going to be false in a couple of weeks. a theorem is forever. All right, so that's part one of neural networks. Okay, so that's what happens when you have excitatory coupling. You get fronts. Let me now do, I guess Larry did the Amari thing. I'll do the Amari thing again for you. Is that okay, or do you want... Oh, I'm not going to do any simulations. I'm going to prove it. No, I'm not going to prove it. I'm going to construct it. Oh, incidentally, I want to point out again some really cool work done by Paul Breslov and his collaborators. They've looked at this issue of epsilon, all right, with integrating fire. And what they do is they study a couple of neurons with slow synapses, okay? And what they prove is as epsilon gets bigger, then the sort of mean field theory becomes unstable through a bunch of complex bifurcations, and you get chaotic stuff just with a pair of guys, okay? So in other words, As somebody, who asked, one of you guys asked, what happens when epsilon's not small? They always ask that. In fact, it does break down. But Breslov's been able to show that it breaks down in a rather interesting and dramatic fashion for the integrating fire model. Okay? The nice thing about integrating fire and also the theta model and things is you can explicitly figure out what these what the functions are. All right, so let's do the Amari case. Here's the Amari model, all right, I'll write it down. dSdt equals, this is not exactly the Amari model, okay? This is like the Amari model because I can't go to some other, this is like the Amari, the analog of the Amari model. Okay? H is a Heaviside step function, okay? So H of U, so the firing rate looks like this. Okay, and so this is UT, threshold. So what the Amari model, we're interested in finding solutions that are localized in space. All right, so we're looking for solutions that are a bump in space. All right, so we're going to look for solutions where S of x is greater than 0 for minus a less than x less than a, and S of x equals 0 for x a member of minus infinity a union a infinity. Okay? So we're looking for solutions like this. So basically, x is going to look like that. All right? And in fact, it will look like 1/2 here and 0 here. You'll see that shortly. All right? So our goal is to find out whether there exist such solutions and what they look like. Now, what are the assumptions? Let's not make any assumptions at all on G yet, okay? Let's see if we can construct them. I'm going to let U of x equal the integral from minus infinity to infinity G of x minus y S of y dy. I'm looking for stationary solutions to this. 0 equals h of this integral. No, I just write it like this. I'm looking for solutions like that. So you can see right away that if the Heaviside step function is 1, then S is 1/2, and if the Heaviside step function is 0, then S is 0. So S is going to either be 1/2 or 0. So the synapses are firing 1/2 probability or not at all. All right, you see? All right. So how do we figure out what A is? We have to figure out what the width of this bump is. Well, what do we know? We know that U of x is this. So U of x is equal to 1/2 minus a to a, g of x minus y dy, right? Because s is 0 outside of that interval, and it's 1/2 everywhere else. See? And what are the conditions? What's the definition of a? U of a has to be equal to U threshold, right? Because that's exactly the width of the bump. If U of x is, so at a, remember, because it's only between minus a and a that s is 1/2. And so that's exactly where this has to equal threshold, right? So U of a equals U threshold. What's U of a equal to? And U of minus a equals U threshold, right? On either side. What's U of A look like? U of A is 1/2 the integral minus A to A, G of X, or G of A minus Y dy, right? Which is just equal to 1/2 0 to 2A G of Y dy. Okay? Just change variables. All the usual crap that you learned in calculus that you forgot, that slept through. All right? Oh, I never use that. You ever hear those morons click and clack? They go on about how we shouldn't teach math anymore because it's useless. And same with that Rosie O'Donnell. Somebody should shoot her. Yeah. She thinks, oh, why do we need math? We all have calculators. Huh. You know, why do we need artists? We have crayons. Yeah. I mean, you know, why do we need authors? Jeez, these morons. Anyway, there should be some sort of rule about speaking in public if your brain is smaller than a certain vegetable. Anyway, I'd rather hear from Divine than from Rosie O'Donnell. Anyway, so the condition is simply that U sub T, the threshold, is 0 to 2A G of Y dy. There we go. That's the condition for the existence of a bump. Everybody see that? And what does g of y look like? Well, it depends on what g looks like. Let's suppose that g is a nice Gaussian. Okay, if g is a nice Gaussian, what does this integral look like? It looks like this. Right? The old ERF, you guys have seen ERF before, right? ERF girls are, well, never mind. No. Oh, old Jeff Goldblum movie. All right, so now, your threshold, for various values of your threshold, there exists a unique bump. However, you can show, and I'll leave this as an exercise to the reader, that this bump is unstable. Okay? And what this does, what this bump serves as, is as a threshold to a spatial problem. If you start with initial conditions that are bigger than, this is this little bump that looks like this. All right, if you start with initial conditions that look like this, for example, what happens? This grows into a pair of oppositely traveling waves. Okay? So this thing acts as a saddle point between the state of a traveling propagating wave, or if you start with initial conditions inside here, then it just collapses back down to rest. So this thing is a separatrix in infinite dimensional space between traveling waves and collapse, okay? So this bump has a physical use, but it's unstable and it's not a working memory. How do you get a good stable bump? Well, you need to bring in a Mexican hat, all right? So if you make G of Y look like this, all right, what do you get then? If you make g of y look like that, what does the integral of g look like? It looks like this. Okay? This could fall below zero. It doesn't matter. All right. Now, if you have a threshold that is between here and here, suppose you have a threshold, you have two possible widths, A1 and A2. You can prove that this one is unstable and this one is stable, and that corresponds to a stable bump. What is this one? This one acts as a separatrix between exciting the medium and staying up in a localized bump or collapse. Okay? So these things all have nice intuitive meaning, and so that's how you get a bump. You need a Mexican hat. What happens if you have a wrinkled Mexican hat? All right? Oh, here's another thing. Here's a thing you can prove. Prove that if this function has infinite support, that is to say, it doesn't stop after a finite width and then go zero, prove that there cannot be more than one bump. Okay? There's an exercise for you. That's a very hard exercise, okay? But it can be done. What happens if you have a wrinkled Mexican hat? All right, what would happen if you have that? Now you might say, why the hell would I have that? Well, it turns out that in the prefrontal cortex, that some nice anatomy by Dave Lewis and stuff indicates, like, if you inject dye into here and then you look at what happens, you see clusters of stuff turned on that moves away. So you see this sort of periodic modulation in the synaptic strength. Okay? It doesn't just go monotonically, it goes periodically. Alright? So that's the motivation for this. So what do you get then? Well, then what does this function look like? This function looks like this. Right? There's infinitely many wiggles if you use like a cosine. And now you can see that you can get lots of different bumps. And the way they come and go is really interesting. And for those of you who are interested in dynamical systems, it turns out that this becomes like a Shilnikov type of problem. You can get a whole panoply of really cool solutions to this. But again, that's math nonsense and it's just for fun. Right. In any event, there's a neural network. Now, you can do all this in not in one space dimension, but in two space dimensions. What happens in two space dimensions when you have a smooth nonlinearity and you have a Mexican hat. Can anybody tell me what happens in two space dimensions? What you expect to happen? So here's the equation. Ds dt equals f of what can you expect to happen there? Well, of course, all kinds of things can happen. But one of the things that can happen with a Mexican hat is you get spatially periodic patterns. Okay? And there are some of us who believe that those correspond to mescaline-induced hallucinations. Right? So I'll leave it at that. If you want to read more about it, you have to download a certain paper and lick page 17. There's a little red dot. But you have to have the right kind of inkjet printer. Okay. So I guess I will stop here because I'm kind of tired. And thanks a lot. So if there's any questions or anything else, no questions? That's good, you fell asleep. No.
I was just wondering.
Wait. Who's? Go ahead.
You always have the stable bound. Should be. Are there some constraints, more inhibition or more excitation in the Mexican head? The total integral should be positive or negative?
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter here. For the Amari bump, it doesn't really matter. I mean, if it goes like this, that's all right too. That we're violating now the. Obviously that the integral was 1, but that doesn't matter for the Amari bump. Okay, so it doesn't matter, except that the difference is how low the threshold can be in order to get a bump. Herman?
In 1D, you would not get a periodic
bump. Oh, you could also. Yes, you can. Oh, you can for a smooth nonlinearity. Oh, yes, I'm sorry. You can either get one bump or a periodic pattern of bumps, but you can't get two bumps. That's what I want to eliminate. You can't get just a pair of bumps, okay? But you can get a periodic thing. Absolutely, absolutely. Oh, good point. That's right. You can get periodic solutions to this, but you cannot get a pair of bumps. And it's really neat. You can write down differential equations for the dynamics of these bumps as a function of time. You can write down approximate dynamics, and you can watch them. They push each other apart. They repel. And if you have finite support, then they stop after they reach the distance. But if you have infinite support, they continue to push each other apart. Or if they're too close, they pull each other together. All right. Any other questions? All right.